William Finnegan is an author and staff writer with The New Yorker, best known for covering conflicts in Somalia, Sudan, and Mexico, in gritty corners of America and South Africa, war and peace, life and death, policy failures, and injustice. Well, he's covered it all. So it makes perfect sense that his new memoir is about surfing. His new book, already a bestseller, is Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life. Finnegan says surfing only looks like a sport, and to initiates, it is something else entirely, a beautiful addiction, a demanding course of study, a morally dangerous pastime, a way of life. William Finnegan is the author of several books, Cold New World, A Complicated War, and Crossing the Line. He's twice been a National Magazine Award finalist and has won numerous journalism awards. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and has been since 1987. It's a great pleasure to welcome William Finnegan to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
It's a delight to have you here. I'm a great fan of this book and of your work in general. I'm curious as to how long it's been in you.
This book?
Yes.
Well, I've had this, you know, very intense sort of 50-year surfing life, so most of that time, I guess. But I wrote a piece for the magazine in the early 90s about a guy I used to surf with in San Francisco. And it took me a long time to write the piece. As you mentioned, I mostly read about politics and conflict, you know, these kind of subjects that have their own urgency, and I found it hard to sort of justify spending all the time trying to write about surfing. But I finally got that piece done, and it came out in the magazine, and it got a big reaction, and it was kind of in the aftermath. I sort of backed into writing this book. It was in the reaction to that piece where I thought, no, that's not really, if I was going to tell a surf story, that's not the one I'd tell. I'd tell all these other ones about other places and other people, and then committed to do so, and then it took me another, I don't know, 20 years to get it finished.
How did you come to surfing in the first place?
Well, I grew up in Southern California. You know, family went to the beach a lot, had friends who belonged to a surf club down in Orange County, and was around, you know, body surfed a lot as a kid. And you need to do a sort of apprenticeship before you get on a surfboard, usually, you know, a lot of time in the ocean just to get to understand how waves work. And so I put in a few years doing that, and then I finally got on a surfboard when I was 10.
So is that part of it for people who are as addicted, if you will, as you are, to come to the sport at a young age?
It's pretty important. I mean, it's very hard to learn surfing. I haven't known anyone really to pick it up over the age of maybe 15 or 16. I know a lot of people to try, but it's really hard to pick up. There are different kinds of surfboards. Surfboards changed when I was young. There was a kind of design revolution, and something called the shortboard was invented in 1968, and that's what people mostly ride now. And those are much more difficult. They're tiny. They don't float well. They kind of sit underwater. You have to. It's a bit of a magic trick to catch a wave and spring up, and then they, you know, are fun to surf, but they're hard. Then there's what are now called longboards, you know, 9 or 10 foot long, float much higher, paddle much faster, much easier to catch waves. That's the best board to begin on. But it's a hard thing to pick up if you don't start really young and kind of get it in your muscle memory, and especially if you don't spend, as I say, a lot of time in the ocean, because really learning to surf is more about learning to read waves, to understand what they're doing and what they're likely to do next, than it is about the athletics, than it is about riding the waves.
So you talk about the many levels of the sport in the book, obviously. For you, it's multifaceted as to what you get out of it, right?
True. I mean, I live in New York City and surf locally. In fact, I was thinking about dashing to the beach today. There's some little waves. You know, on a kind of small day around here, it's sort of one thing. You get some exercise, you get out in the ocean, you may have some fun and splash around. On another day, here, perhaps in the winter or on a big hurricane swell, or out somewhere in Hawaii or Indonesia, I still take these trips when I can, to more serious waves. it'll be a whole another level of engagement. I mean, you can scare yourself or have a really sort of transformative experience or any number of travails. So it does vary a lot.
Talk about Hawaii and your, I mean, this is really sort of where you come of age with the sport, isn't it?
Yeah, we moved to Hawaii. I grew up, as I mentioned, in greater LA, and we moved to Hawaii when I was 13. My dad got a job there, and I was already surfing, and it was just a dream come true. We lived in a little cottage on the backside of Diamond Head, quite near the water, and so I sort of got to know these local spots and surfed a lot. And my style actually changed. I had a kind of mainland cold water style. And the guys I was surfing with, the guys I befriended, my best friends were these three Hawaiian brothers. They're called Kukui's, really good surfers and, multi-generational family of surfers. And a really different style, the sort of traditional island style with sort of wider stance and lower center of gravity, and it sort of changed my style and really changed my life living there. I started the book there partly because it was an interesting place to get to know and surf, but also because it was very intense. My school I went to was quite rough, and very few white kids, and a lot of racial tension, and I'd come out of this very white bred Southern California suburb, and so this was all new to me, this kind of world of different sorts of people, most of them don't like you, or you have to get to understand them. And so a lot of my career has ended up being writing about far-flung places and cultural difference and conflict, and so I start the book there.
And oh yeah, it's also the 60s.
Yep, it's the 60s. Well, the 60s took place at different times in some way. I mean, the book starts in the mid-60s when we're living in Hawaii, and the 60s per se hadn't really kicked off yet. And later in the 60s, along came the sort of summer of love in San Francisco and slopping over to Hawaii and drugs and the rest of it.
You said a moment ago about that idea of for a good surfer. What makes a good surfer?
Well, it's obviously somebody who's skilled and understands the ocean. I mean a given spot, a given wave. It's remarkable in a way when with other surfers, I'm forever kind of drooling over videos of great waves and great surfers, or if you're lucky, you happen to be there, seeing somebody who's really really good, top pro or something, surfing good waves. And it's funny how often what you're saying is, how did he know that? How did he know the wave was going to do that? In other words, anticipating from within, chaotic or intense moments where you perhaps can't even see, and yet understanding that the wave is going to do something that none of us who've been surfing our whole lives, but we would never have understood the wave would do that. That's kind of what I mean about reading waves. So really good surfers, often it's just, you say that guy has it wired. He completely understands this spot. He's always in the right spot. He's always getting the best waves. And you can't, his thinking is just more advanced than yours about every little eddy and swell angle and every rock and tide change and swell and wind change. And so it's a strange thing. I mean, one doesn't usually think about of surfers as intellectuals or the intellectual work of surfing. I mean, it sounds pretentious, but when you see some guys out in the water just down the end of the street someplace, what they're mostly doing out there is trying to understand what the ocean's doing. That's the sort of primary occupation.
You read about this in the book and so I'll ask the question. I mean, you feel that you have in your life found the perfect wave.
Well, that phrase, the perfect wave, kind of got, I mean, surfers talk about perfection. Oh, it was perfect, you should have been. It's a very common phrase. But surfers actually know that there's no such thing.
Yes.
That is to say, waves are they're not like some fixed object in nature. It's not a diamond or a rose or something. I mean, it's an explosion. It's the end of a long chain of you know, weather action and ocean reaction, and it explodes, you know, the ocean explodes against some reef or beach somewhere. And but there are better and worse waves, and there are great, great waves to ride. And there are spots that really have an unusual number of great waves, you know, perfectly shaped, here you hear me using the word perfect, a perfectly shaped reef or sandbar or river mouth or whatever it is, cobblestone point. And it's true that when I was in my 20s and bumming around in the South Pacific looking for surf, a friend and I ended up camping on an uninhabited island in Fiji that had what was the best wave either of us had ever seen in our lives. And we camped there for weeks and weeks and just had no water on the island, no fresh water, and so some fishermen, local fishermen, would stop by once a week, bring supplies. And we just surfed this place when it was a little fickle, but when it broke, and that was about as close as you could ever come. It was very shallow and very, very fast, and as I say, a bit fickle, but it was a truly incredible wave. And nobody, you know, knew about it, it seemed, but us, a couple of other guys off yachts. But now, unfortunately, we tried to keep it a secret. That's a big thing in surfing, is to try to find spots that nobody knows about and just kind of keep them under wraps. But that place later got discovered and is now one of the most famous waves in the world.
What has your reaction? I find it interesting because you talk about, really, this is not something that you would put front and center in your resume for a while. And what does that say about the sport, that there's people like you who do it but don't talk about it, really?
Yeah, it's well, in my case, I was always an aspiring writer. I wrote fiction. I wrote a lot, and but was mainly a surf bum. I just, you know, worked jobs to sort of feed my habit and lived all over the world chasing waves. And then at a certain point, it really changed my life, sort of made a turn. And one of the jobs I got was teaching in a black high school in Cape Town, in South Africa, during the bad old days of apartheid. And it turned out to be a very, very intense year. You know, kids went on strike against apartheid and education. And I was in the midst of all that. And somehow by the end of that year, I lost interest in the kind of fiction I was writing at the time. And was really just interested in political journalism. And so I kind of reinvented myself, started freelancing as a political journalist, and eventually got on staff at The New Yorker, but, you know, spent a number of years freelancing and just doing political journalism. And somehow, yeah, in that world, especially as I started writing more opinion columns and, you know, sort of debating policy in public, it seemed strange to sort of come out of the closet as a surfer. I mean, like, I was going to kind of risk my credibility just because the stereotype of surfers is so anti-intellectual and not, you know, based on nothing. I mean, there are an awful lot of sort of stoned out surf dudes everywhere nowadays. And yet there are plenty of surfers who, you know, do serious work in the world as well. And some are not shy about it at all. But it took me a while to publish that piece I mentioned in The New Yorker that sort of outed me as a surfer. And of course, it turned out nobody cared, and nobody said, "No, we don't have to take you seriously. You're just a dumb surfer." I actually never heard that. So
with that said, the book comes out and it's a bestseller. I mean, you found your audience.
Yeah, it's done amazingly well with readers. I mean, people laugh at me. I've published a bunch of, you know, serious journalistic books that, you know, got good reviews and won some prizes and were taken all very seriously, but they didn't really sell. You know, they were like, good for you, good book. But maybe this one's a little more fun. And it's been selling really well. And I've been tons of mail, really interesting mail, including a lot of people sort of surfacing from the distant corners of my past. You know, "Hey, Bill, it's me, the guy from the yacht and, you know, Vanuatu, and don't you remember we surfed, you know, some obscure place in Indonesia together," and just people with both with surfing experiences, lots of actually reader reaction, sort of correcting me, saying this is not a book about surfing, you know, which I love to hear. You know, it's about men, it's about love, it's about obsession or how to live or you know, however people read it, because it is an autobiography. It's not all surfing at all. It's sort of the story of my life, and but basically it's about surfing. So
the name of the book,
it's really gratifying.
Absolutely. It's the name of the book is Barbarian Days, a Surfing Life. It's published by Penguin Press. William Finnegan, what a great pleasure to have you on the program again. Great fan of the book and of your work, and I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan, published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.